All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I am your host, as always, Jay Nickel. And today we are going to do the elk hunt wrap-up podcast. Now, I was trying to get this done, you know, a week or two ago, and it's just been flat out since I got home, trying to crush out reviews, build mindful reviews, got a raffle going, the whole nine yards. So we're doing it today. Now, I'm not going to do a play-by-play of the hunt. I think the film that I put out, it's an hour and a half long. If you're looking for a play-by-play of the hunt, that's where you're going to go, because I wouldn't be able to do it justice on this podcast anyways, and you're better off watching that film. So if that's what you want, go there. What I'm going to do is I put up a Q&A on the drive home, and I got an unbelievable amount of questions. So we're going to use those questions as a guide for me to share kind of what I learned about the hunt and give some feedback on the gear that I was using and the kind of style of hunting I was doing, being, you know, sleeping in the back of my truck every night and that kind of stuff. So that's how, that's the framework that we're going to use to go through the hunt. Now, little bit of housekeeping. Like I already mentioned, the elk film is live. So the link will be in the description for the show. If you haven't seen it yet, I highly recommend you check it out. I'm really proud. I think it turned out really well. Every time I do one of these films, I'm really trying to set the bar a little bit higher and do something a little bit different and a little bit better than I did last time. And I felt like I did that on this one. So if you haven't checked it out, please click the link, check it out. I think you'll like it. If you have checked it out, I appreciate the support and would love your feedback and, you know, what you liked, what you didn't, and all the rest of it. Up next, I am currently in the middle of a four-part review series. I'm comparing Sitka apparel against Stone Glacier apparel. From Sitka, we're looking at the Apex Pants Core Lightweight Hoodie, Ambient Hoodie, and the Kelvin Aerolite Jacket. From Stone Glacier, we are looking at the De Havilland Pants Avro Synthetic Hoodie, Circlite Jacket, and the Grumman Puffy Jacket. And I'm basically doing a head-to-head of each of the counterpart products in a four-part video series. Two are already posted, two more will come next week, and I'm doing a raffle for basically a four-part apparel kit from either company. So you can pick Stone Glacier gear or Sitka gear, or you can mix and match, but the winner will get to choose a pair of pants, a base layer, a mid dynamic insulation layer, and an outer static insulation layer. And I can help you. We can hop on Zoom if you want some feedback, if you want my opinion, or if you know what you want, fantastic. Let's pick it. Let's get it ordered. But that raffle is live right now. Go to mindful-reviews.com if you're not a member already, to become a member and then be able to purchase tickets. And if you are a member, you already know this because I made a post on the site. If you got any questions about the raffles or membership, please don't hesitate to get in touch with me, jay@mindfulhunter.com. Other than that, I think everything else is copacetic. We're good to cruise ahead. So before we dive into the questions, I want to address the knee issue and the ATV accident issue. So I touched on this in the film, but I didn't go into great detail. So I will dive into greater detail for everybody now. I want to preface this by saying I've driven quads for 20 years. I have thousands of hours driving ATVs between tree planting, hunting, forestry engineering, like very familiar with driving quads in super sketchy conditions and have not had one single accident my entire life. And that's why I think this is important to talk about, because I think in hunting, we find ourselves, no matter how long we're doing this, we find ourselves in unique situations. And basically, we'll go through the decision-making process or the lack of decision-making process that I kind of executed and why I think what happened ended up happening. But the underlying cause here is that I was so jacked up from killing that bull that I was not thinking clearly. Luckily, there was a couple buddies there with me. The takeaway for me is that you just slow down, man, especially in those moments when like you're flying, you're jacked up. It's like, take a pause, catch your breath, relax, think clearly, think through things. So anyways, we load everything up on the quad. The quad is loaded to the nines. Like you can just feel it. Like it's bottomed right out. There's, You know, I got 308 pounds back from the butcher. So there's probably 400 pounds because of all the extra bone and the extra packs and all our gear. I'm 240. So imagine a Yamaha Kodiak 450 with an extra probably 650 pounds on it between me and the elk. I get all the way out of the bush. I get all the way down the cut line. It's like a kilometer and a half. No issues, no problem. I'm literally at the road. And when we're coming up out of the road onto the, off the cut line and up onto the road, there's a big kicker, like a big kind of steep embankment where they've, you know, come down into the cut line. And it was funny because Nick even mentioned it when we got to the quad. He's like, we're going to have to get off the quad at the road because it's too steep. And, Ken made a comment, you know, kind of like, we'll be fine. I made a similar comment and I kind of let those comments kind of play into my head, like total, you know, macho masculine bullshit. I'm like, I got this. I don't need any help. They were literally like 100 yards behind me. I could have stopped. I could have unloaded the quad. I could have waited. They could have held the front of the quad down. I did. It would have taken zero effort to stop this from happening. I did none of those things. And kind of punched it, really got up on my toes and leaned over the front of the quad. If the quad had been empty, I would have went up that thing, no problem. But the quad was not empty. And there was two bags of elk on the back, one bag of elk on the front. The weight pulled it back and it basically just flipped back over right on top of me. So it flipped over backwards, but as it came over backwards, it also rolled to the side. And I went to the other side to get out of the way because I thought this thing's dumping on my head. I'm done is what I thought was happening. And my left leg got caught between the front fender and the handlebar. And when it came down, it just snap, crackle, pop, absolutely shredded my knee. It was not like a gentle sprain. It was not like I heard pops. I felt pops. I could hear, feel things tearing. Like it, all the weight came down on the outside of the knee, perpendicular to the way my knee is supposed to bend. So imagine if you got like tackled from the side, right on the side of the knee, and my knee basically bent, I don't know, 30, 40, 60 degrees in the wrong direction. And super sharp pain, knew I was hooped, but I didn't get, you know, my head crushed. So I was super grateful. I was able to pull myself out from underneath the quad, immediately couldn't put any weight on the leg. Had to hop up this embankment on 1 foot. You know, deep appreciation for Ken and Nick. They literally took care of everything. Unloaded the quad, got the quad back to the road. They literally took care of everything. Unloaded the quad, went and got the truck, loaded the quad, loaded the meat in the coolers, got all my gear situated, you know, badass, you know, such good guys, totally had my back. I was screwed. I couldn't walk. I could barely do anything. Drove straight to the hospital in Chetwynd. Didn't really get a whole lot of help there. Basically said, yeah, take a bunch of Advil. And if you want to go get a knee sleeve, that's fine. You're not going to hurt anything. But didn't know if I'd hurt my tendons or ligaments or torn or didn't get me an x-ray, literally did nothing. So I said, all right, drove to Prince George, went to the pharmacy, spent $100 on, you know, a variety of things to kind of help me get home, you know, in a more pain-free manner. And then tried to put some ice and heat on it for the next couple of days while I kind of worked, stayed at the hotel that night and then worked my way home to Vancouver the next day. And then really, I'm out of commission and don't know much for a week because I'm waiting for the swelling to go down enough that somebody can look at it. And it blows up like a balloon. Doesn't really get super bruised, but swelling was wild. I had cankles on one side literally for 2 straight weeks. And then finally yesterday, at the 2 week mark, it had got noticeably better. I was walking around a little bit better. Still couldn't bend my knee very far at all, but basically got in to see my physio, who's an absolute wizard, costs a fortune, but is unbelievably talented. And he said, okay. Oh, I also went in to see another doctor and got an MRI referral because you can go get a private MRI, but you still need to get a referral for it. So saw a doctor, got the private MRI referral, scheduled that for next week, saw my physio this week. All this time, I'm injecting growth hormone directly into the area around my knee twice a day to try and expedite the healing process. I've ordered peptides, BPC 157 and TB 500. They're on the way. They should be here any day now. Physio says, yeah, you tore your MCL for sure, and you definitely have some muscular damage on top of that. The medialis, the teardrop part of the quad is probably torn, and probably some of the connective tissue from your calf to your knee has been torn. But he was also like, that's all stuff that actually heals pretty well. So we're planning to hit it up with PRP, prolotherapy, ozone injections, growth hormone, peptides, and then I'll see the physio once a week for probably the next 3 to 4 weeks. He's also an osteopath. So he deals a lot with putting bones in their proper place, because a lot of times some of the dysfunction that we have is because our joints and bones aren't tracking correctly. So they're putting undue pressure on muscles in the wrong way. So he kind of lined me back up. And then he also did IMS, which is like dry needling. It's kind of like acupuncture, except they got these little barbs on them and they're trying to hit the nerves and certain muscles. And they basically stick needles in you and drag it back and forth across a nerve while your leg freaks out and flexes and kind of jumps all over the place. It's kind of terrible. Like, it's very painful. But it also works amazingly well. So he did that in my quad so that my quad would loosen up and kind of let go, because it was still very tense. And I was getting these crazy Charlie horses out of nowhere. So anyways, that's where we're at with the knee. Took a couple weeks off the gym. Haven't done any hiking. Colorado is still on. I don't care if I have to strap two pieces of rebar to the sides of my leg and hobble around like a moron. This will not get in the way of my next hunt. And as long as I do the rehab that I'm supposed to do and take all the steps that I'm supposed to take, I think I'll be back in fighting shape in no time. So I will keep you guys updated. If anybody has any particular experience with this and wants to provide some feedback on things that worked for them, I'm all ears. If you have any more specific questions about what I'm doing, because it could help you in some way, don't hesitate to get in touch. But that's where we're at with the knee. Okay, now let's go to the questions. So first question up, what is your bow and arrow setup? So I run a Hoyt RX-7 Ultra at 70 pounds. It has Ghast Ghost camo strings on it. I'm trying to think what else matters. I only run one stabilizer on the front. It's an 8-inch. And then there's a little tiny stabilizer it comes with that goes on the very bottom. I run a Black Gold Pro Hunter HD sight. It's a 5-pin slider. And I run the Hampski Epsilon drop away rest. And I think that's really all that matters on the bow. Now, the arrow setup weighs 485 grains. It's flying at 283 feet per second. I use Black Eagle Rampage. I four-fletch with AAE 2.6 hybrids. I wrap with a Boning, fluorescent yellow carbon arrow wrap, 5-inch long. I use Iron Will collars, inserts, and broadheads. So I have, all together, it's 165 grain point weight. So I use a 25 grain collar, 10 grain insert or 20 grain insert, whatever it is. And then 125 grain solid S125 broadhead. And both the animals I killed this year, this is devastating. I won't shoot anything but fixed blade broadheads. It just, dude, they cover your ass so much. So when I shot the bear, it was an easy shot, 15-yard chip shot at like 45 degrees. That was the only part. And the takeaway from that is, like, remember, if you're going to shoot directly up or down, if you're going to shoot at a steep angle, don't try and pull your bow back at that angle. What you want to do, because you're going to have a hard time anchoring and setting your peep up, what you want to do is draw your bow back straight, like you normally would, perpendicular to the ground, right? And then anchor, lower your face, look through your peep, line up your sight, and then treat your upper body as one full piece, like a big T, and then lean back at the hips. And you kind of want your back shoulder, your front hand, and your hips all to rock back. And then you're going to stay in one solid position. Because when I first pulled back, I kind of forgot about that for some reason and basically tried to pull back right on the bear, and nothing was lining up appropriately. Then I basically remembered, yeah, you're doing this all wrong, man. Calm down. Realign myself, lean back, shot him, double lung, pass through. That arrow would have gone another 150, 200 yards. I mean, who knows? It doesn't, those things go through bears like butter. It was wild. And basically the bear just dropped out of the tree dead. Did not take one single step. Dropped out of the tree, gave one moan. I literally didn't wait at all. Walked up to it, you know, touched it with my boot, and the thing was dead. So, and then with my elk, here's what happened. So the elk comes in dead on, and I have a great frontal shot at like 18, maybe even less, maybe 15 yards. Bow is drawn back. Elk is looking at me. He's not moving. I'm not moving. Everything is perfect. I lean my head down to look through the peep, and it's twisted, and it's twisted bad. And I cannot see through it at all. And so, I mean, long story short, I had to wait. I finally let down. I was able to untwist the peep. And then he turns, gives me a perfect broadside shot while I'm untwisting the peep. By the time I get to full draw, he's looking perfectly away from me. And he's not running, but he's definitely like, I knew this is it. He's leaving. And then he basically turns to look back at me, giving me a very steep quartering away shot. I knew it was aggressive, but I also knew if I didn't take this shot, this bull was gone. So I decided to take the shot. I definitely smashed into elk. Once we saw what had happened, I definitely hit some junk on the way and deflected a little bit and hit further back than I wanted to. But this is where those, you know, having a solid draw weight, and I have a 30-inch draw length, so I'm kicking out quite a bit of horsepower. It kind of gives, it builds in a little bit of wiggle room, a little bit of mercy for, you know, when you do things that are not completely optimal. It's basically, we gave the animal 45 minutes. We were just about to head in, and then we heard a stick pop, and it was like, what? And then we waited another 2-3 minutes and we heard a crash. We're like, okay, he finally went down. And when we got in there, he still wasn't dead. And basically that's when we saw my arrow had hit far back, but it still hit some vitals. So he was bleeding out pretty dramatically, and it did take him an hour to die, but he didn't go more than 60 yards. Like, it didn't even take 5 minutes to find him. Like, he was right there. So a couple takeaways from that is, like, I love a good fixed blade broadhead. And give it time, because when you run in there, they want to lay down. If they're hurt bad, they don't want to run. They don't want to leave. They want to lay down. And the only reason they're going to get up and run is if you put pressure on them and make them feel pressured. And so, you know, I'm going to give all of us a little pat on our back for having the presence of mind to just sit and wait it out. And wait it out for a good long time. There was no way we were going in there any sooner than 45 minutes. So anyway, long story short, that's my bow and arrow setup. Okay, another guy says, first time hunting ever. A lot of people complain about hunting pressure. How do you adapt? I mean, I think it's like anything else in life. You need to do exactly that, adapt. And you need to not let it get to you. There was definite hunting pressure for me this year. It wasn't like unbearable or overwhelming, but there were definitely days where I was frustrated because plan A would have people at it, plan B would have people at it, and then you're like, plan C actually sucks so bad, is it even really a plan? So rule number one, don't get frustrated and don't use it as an excuse to put out a half-ass attempt. You know, the real killers are getting shit done no matter who else is out there. And I know it's kind of arrogant, but I always tell myself a little story that, like, listen, they may be around, but they're not going to go like I'm going to go. Or, yeah, they're parked here, but they're not willing to walk as far as I'm willing to walk. Or they're not, you know, another thing that serves me very well, sleeping in the back of the truck. Like, they might get here, but they're not going to get here as early as I am, because I'm sleeping here and I'm going to walk down this trail at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's one of my strategies for dealing with Colorado hunting pressure. So have a lot of plans, like more plans than you think. Like, I'm talking waypoints all over the place. Every potential trailhead e-scouted out, like 2 to 3 different plans for every day, so that if you show up and you're getting shut down by hunting pressure, you don't want to be in that situation where, like, you say to yourself, now what do I do? My goal, for example, for Colorado is to never be in the situation where I have to say, now what do I do? Because that's going to shut down your ability to think quickly and effectively. And you're going to get paralyzed and you're going to be locked in indecision and you're going to start wasting time. So if I have so many plans that, like, no matter what happens, I always know what's happening next. Okay, this one's blown, that one's blown, that one's blown. Fine, we're on to this one. Go to that one. Didn't find anything. Okay, now we go to this one. And then every night when I get in the back of the truck, it's like, okay, replan. This is what I saw today. How does that influence tomorrow? Make more plans for tomorrow. Because I think that dead time and that indecision is the mind killer. You know, one of my favorite movies is Dune. I loved the old one. I love the new one even more. It's just an amazing story and movie and everything. And there's this saying in Dune that fear is the mind killer. And I think when it comes to hunting, doubt is the mind killer. Doubt in yourself, doubt in your plan, doubt in your ability to deal with more people, doubt in the terrain, doubt in the presence of animals. Like, I am always more successful when I am almost delusionally confident. And there is zero doubt. So how do you eradicate doubt? You check the boxes. What do I mean by check the boxes? I mean, you do your homework before you go out there. And in this particular example that I'm talking about, that means plans. That means e-scouting. That means phoning people. I bet you I've talked to 15 people on the phone about Colorado. I bet you I've sent 30 or 40 emails. I mean, like, every single little thread that I can find on the internet that has anything to do with my unit, I'm hitting people up and I'm prepared with good, solid questions. All right, I got a little bit fired up there, but essentially the takeaway here is, for things that you can't control on a hunt, whether that be other hunting pressure or anything else that falls into that category, first step is to realize there's nothing I can do about it. Second step is to have a good plan. Third step is to not get overwhelmed by the fact that you can't do anything about it. And I think this is where experience really benefits people. And as a newer hunter, you're kind of screwed. You're not going to have a ton of spots at first. You might only have 1 or 2 good ideas, and those might be taken by other people. So recognize that your first couple hunts might be closer to scouting trips than hunting trips. And this is where the importance of preseason scouting really comes into play. So that would be, you know, off the top of my head, that would be what I would recommend for hunting in areas with lots of pressure. I will say this, I haven't spent a lot of time in any of the crazy places in the States where people go on and on about the pumpkin patches and anything like this, but I've hunted some fairly pressured areas in BC a couple times, and I have hunted some pressured places in the States. It's never held me back, you know? Both times I was up in the piece, there was lots of pressure. You know, this year and last year, I was able to kill an elk. So I think more people use it for an excuse than anything else. So there's my 2 cents. All right, up next is 415 grain arrow too light for elk. I shot a bull high with a 64-pound bow and it didn't penetrate. There are tons of dudes killing elk with 400-ish grain arrows. Get any lighter than that, I'm not a big fan, but I have no problem with the guys who like to go a little lighter and a little faster. I just did a podcast with Dirk Durham. He's pulling 60, 65 pounds, and that dude is a straight assassin. So if your arrow didn't penetrate at 64 pounds with a 415 grain arrow, that is a function of shot placement, not a function of an equipment malfunction or error. There's some stuff higher up that if you hit, you're going to stop dead no matter what you're shooting, unless you're shooting a cannon. But even 64 pounds at 415 grains, you'd be able to go through a rib, you'd be able to go through some minor stuff and should not have a problem. And some people feel like those lighter draw weights enable them to shoot more accurately. It's kind of like the same argument about using a lighter caliber, because there's less recoil and because there's a lower draw weight, you're more relaxed and you tend to shoot better. So I have no problems with 64 pounds at 415 grains. Up next, any tips for a first-time elk hunter that got an LEH in Sechelt? I've never been to Sechelt, so I can't make any direct comments on that. I think it's a relatively good area. I know who this person is, and I've been following your stories, and I saw that you were out scouting and you found some good bulls. So I think you're doing everything right that you can be. If you wanted some like philosophical advice, enjoy the hunt, because you're likely going to put a lot of pressure on yourself to produce, because those tags are rather sought after, and it is an LEH, and it is, you know, you are a less experienced hunter, so you're going to really want to show that, you know, you can be successful. And I think all that's important, and I think putting some pressure on yourself is a good thing. But also recognize that you are one of the few people in the world who's getting the chance to hunt Roosevelt elk in British Columbia. So just take a moment, take a beat, and appreciate that for what it is. I'm fully confident that you'll be able to take down a bull with that tag. So just remember to appreciate the hunt for what it is. Should meat eaters stick to TV shows and stop acquiring gear brands? I could do an entire podcast just on that. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't even watch the TV show anymore. I still like the podcast. I like the guests and I like the topics, but I can't do the TV show anymore. It's just turned into like these big bush parties where they take like 15 guys hunting. And I was like, what? If you watch the old ones, like the first couple seasons, there was a coos deer hunt in there that was like incredible. It was just Steve. And listen, man, all good things come to an end. It's like all TV shows, right? It's like, why didn't they stop at season 3? Because as soon as they got to 4 and 5, it's like, turned into dog shit. I still think they do a lot of good. I still have a lot of respect for some people who work at that company. I think they're, you know, legit killers. I'm not a fan of roll-up strategies in business in general, which is all they're doing, you know, because it just requires less profit for the guy at the end of the food chain, or greater prices for the people who are buying the product. Like the more middlemen you put in a business, the more the profit gets chopped up. So I'm not a fan of it in general, but yeah, those are my two thoughts. The TV show, I literally haven't even watched the last 2 seasons. Three seasons ago, I tried watching it. And I'm like, what has this even turned into? Like, it's the same as the books that Steve's putting out. And I don't want to feel like I'm ragging on Steve, because he's probably one of the top 10 individuals responsible for marketing hunting in North America. And he's a great voice for our community. But even books, like the last few books, he got all stoked that he got in the New York Times bestseller look with like a how-to book. It was like a cooking book or something else. And I'm like, dude, go back and read your first 4 or 5 novels, like The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine and American Buffalo. And like, these were great works of literature. Like, that guy is such a good writer, and his ability to weave in historical fact with adventure stories and, you know, it's just, I really miss that, because the TV shows that he was putting out back then and the books that he was writing back then will go down as some of my favorite books and TV shows I've ever seen. And I just feel like the glory days are gone. And now he's writing like children's books and survival guides and putting out, you know, audio campfire books of near-death stories that aren't even really near-death from people who aren't even really telling good stories. Like, it's disappointing. But like I said, all good things must come to an end, and I don't hold it against them. Everybody's got to make a buck so they can do whatever they want to do. Are cover scents worth using? Elk pheromones, even if you're playing the wind. I've only met one guy who's a big fan. That was Nick. I was hunting with him. He did keep spraying it. It stunk, I'll give you that. I wouldn't count on it. It's one of these things that it's so controversial that If you want to do it, go ahead, but I wouldn't want to do it in lieu of playing the wind. Wind has to come before everything when you are hunting elk. It is the first thing, the second thing, and the last thing that you should be worrying about. Because if they catch one tiny scent of you, they are gone. Somebody once told me an elk can hear you three times, see you twice, but only smell you once. And sound, I've come to learn, is like, I don't even care. I try and be noisy because elk are noisy. And if they hear something creeping through the woods, they immediately think predator because only predators creep. So you can make noise. I mean, the elk I shot literally stared at me for 60 seconds and did not run away. But I know he didn't smell me because if they catch one tiny whiff, they're gone. So elk scent will not cover up bad planning for the wind. But maybe it'll help you. I don't know. I doubt it would hurt. Worth it to upgrade from 20-year-old Cabela's Alaskan to an expensive one. They're a lot of, I don't even know what a Cabela's Alaskan is. Is it a backpack? If your backpack is 20 years old, yes, it is worth it to upgrade. Send me some more information. I'll try and give some more specific advice, but I don't know what that is. Were the bulls talking much or did you have to creep in on them? This is an interesting question. The first 2 days, I was getting lots of vocalizations. I could hear elk calling back to me. They were responsive to calls. They weren't crazy engaged. Like I would get those kind of like weak, I hear you over there kind of bugles, but like nobody came running in. But I ran into somebody on the first day, his bull came sprinting in. It was a younger bull, satellite bull, but it did come sprinting in. And then after the first 2 days, a heat wave kicked in and a wind kind of pattern kicked in and elk were dead silent. And then for 4 days in a row, so first 2 days, tons of vocalizations, 4 days in a row, did not hear a peep. And then on day seven, we killed my elk and it was 100% vocally called in. I mean, it was textbook Paul Medell. Like Ken knocked it out of the park and they were raking, they were cow calling, they were bugling, he was barking at them. It was wild, man. And the bull was doing everything back and forth with him. It was fantastic. So I think there was a little bit of environmental factors kind of shutting them down. But I also think people who were better callers were a little bit better at getting them to speak. So I don't want to say that it was all the elk. You know what I mean? Like you get them to talk if you knew what you were doing. What time of day did you end up getting the kill at? I killed my bull at 7:15 in the morning. That's right. Because we walked up to him shortly after 8 and we gave him an hour to expire. Up next, do you enjoy the drive home from hunts? It's a good time to reflect, decompress on success, failures. I love the drive home from hunts. I love driving anything, anytime, anywhere. Long, like I got to drive 23 hours to Colorado. I cannot wait. Listen to some podcasts. Now that I got the new headset, I can record podcasts while I drive. Love it. And the drive home, I know I'm coming home to see my family. It was funny. My barber asked me the other day. Oh no, it was my physio. He's like, so when you're done, is that it? Do you go right home or do you hang out for a couple of days? And I'm like, bro, I sprint. The moment that dead animal hits the ground, I text my wife, mission accomplished. And she's like, how long? And I do some math in my head. If I need to sleep on the road, it does like, I get home as fast as possible. Yes, it's partly for me because I want to see my family. It's more to buy me future credibility for other hunts. Because when my wife sees me run home, the signal to her is that I'm prioritizing family. And so she's more open because she knows, okay, I know you're planning on going away for 2 weeks, but if you kill in 9 days, you're going to come straight home. And I think if you dawdled after your hunts, she wouldn't have that same degree of faith. So, and that drive home is a great time to process. I used to record the wrap-ups for my hunts on the drive home, and then I stopped doing that for some reason, and now I'm recording them a couple days later. I'm going to go back to doing them on the drive home because I feel like it's more raw and it's more authentic and less planned, and it's more in the moment impacted by the hunt that just occurred. So I love it. How do you build up the never give up mentality to keep going? This is such a good question, man. And the bottom line is it's just experience. Like anything in life, I think we have genetic predispositions. So just like bodybuilding or athletics of any kind, you likely have a genetic predisposition one way or another. And then through environment and social circumstances and choices that you can make, you can optimize that genetic predisposition. So I do think I probably happen to be, you know, pretty mentally tough by default. I was probably born that way. I think a lot of the way that I was brought up, a lot of the hardships that I went through when I was younger have aided to that. I have this theory that self-esteem is created by accomplishing things that we thought we were incapable of. And that is a bit of a contradiction in terms, because if you think you were incapable of something, how did you go about accomplishing it? And the bottom line is, in my theory, choice was removed for you. So for whatever reason, you get put in a situation where you have to accomplish something that you think you're incapable of. And then you end up accomplishing it and you're like, oh my God, I can do this? Let me give you an example. So I used to plant trees for a living. And where I planted trees in Ontario is like, you know, 2,000, you got a hat for 2,000 trees in one day. Like it was that big of a deal. And I ended up planting with these highballers. I did this little preseason trip down to Ottawa. And there were dudes there who were just planting 2,000-3,000 trees. So my first week, I just planted 2,000 trees in a day. And everybody was like, oh my God, how did you do that? And I was like, I don't know. I just saw these other guys do it. So it didn't even really occur to me that it would be a problem. I went on at the second last day of my rookie year to plant 7,038 trees in 11 hours and 55 minutes. So I was averaging 600 trees an hour for almost 12 hours. And that was, you know, nobody else, I set a camp record. Nobody else had planted that many trees. And I think it was just because I built up the confidence over that season by consistently breaking numbers and slowly doing more and more and more and just grinding it out. But for people who aren't naturally predisposed to have that kind of mentality, put yourself in a situation where you don't have any choice. Like I can remember having planters that were satisfied to make $150-$200 a day. Like they thought that was all they could do. And my job with them was always to show them that what they thought they were capable of was far less than what they were actually capable of. So I would just simply remove the choice for them. And it was like, well, we're just not leaving until you get this particular number. Or I would just put so much pressure on them all day that they had no choice but to produce. And then once they break those numbers a couple times, they look back and they're like, oh, holy shit, I sold myself short. I was capable of a lot more than I thought I was. So I don't know if it's doing little trips first. I don't know if it's going with somebody who's more confident or more experienced than you are and you have no choice but to just keep up. But essentially, you got to find some way to just keep stacking up examples that you don't quit. And then eventually, you will convince yourself that you are just a guy who doesn't quit by nature. That's just how you're built. And that's kind of how I look at myself right now. I did a big speech on the last podcast I did driving up for Elk about the kind of mindset of a killer and how I had lost that over the last couple of years because I was trying to convince myself to, you know, appreciate the moment and whatever happens, happens. And as long as I'm learning, everything's okay. And a bunch of other bullshit that I don't really believe. And as soon as I put my mind back in that headspace that I am a killer, killers kill, and I'm not leaving here till something dies, it changed. I killed two animals on this trip. And that's how I feel about Colorado. I tell you right now, there's a mule deer coming home with me in the back of that truck. I am so convinced of that truth, and maybe I'll end up being wrong. I don't know, but I can't even express it, man. I can't put it into words how convinced I am that I'm going to kill a mule deer on this next trip. And I think that there's something to that. You know, people who are confident behave differently than people who aren't. And that's something I spent a lot of time talking to Cody about last week. And so I'm not going to rehash that, but I think there's some takeaways in there. Next person asks, very timely, Cirque versus Ambient. I went Cirque Light over Ambient for a variety of reasons this year. Well, I just released a review this morning entitled Stone Glacier Cirque Light versus Sitka Ambient. And I spend 30 minutes detailing my exact thoughts. So I'm not going to waste your time here. If you're interested, go check out that review. And if afterwards you'd like to win one of those pieces of gear, join Mindful Reviews and participate in the raffle. Zach Johnson, have you ever made a mistake while hunting that still bothers you today? Oh, what a good question, man. Because I have these mistakes in life. Well, I mean, the quad bugs me big. Like, that was just stupid. There's zero excuse for that. It is 100% my fault. I'm trying to think. I mean, this isn't so much a mistake, but there was a couple hunts early on that I quit, like mentally. I might not have even gone home super early, but I just phoned it in for the past couple days. I did not hunt with, you know, ferocity or intention. And I know I gave up because a week or so after I got home, I knew I'd given up and I could never take that back. And that just eats at my soul. And that's another reason, going back to that never quit mentality. I know what that feels like, that bitter acid copper taste in the back of my throat of quitting and failure. And I hate it. I hate it with a white hot passion. I would almost rather die, you know. I will grind myself to the bone so I don't have to feel that sensation. So that I definitely still regret to this day, but I try and keep that alive. And here's a weird story for you. The first time I got sober at my year birthday, you get this token, right? In a 12-step program, and you can have whatever you want inscribed on it. And I got Keeping the Moment Alive. And everyone thought that what I meant was like the joy of being 1 year sober. Like, keep that moment alive as an inspiration, encouragement to stay sober moving forward. And I was like, nope. There was this one moment in my apartment the very last day that I used that particular time around, and I broke. I was crying. I wanted to kill myself, literally. In fact, I'd went and picked up an 8-ball, and my whole plan was to get home and shoot the whole thing and just overdose and be dead and be done with it. Because I knew I was broken. I was fucked. And there was no way. In my mind, I had convinced myself there was no way I was ever going to get sober. And I was just going to keep hurting myself and everyone else around me. And I can remember I went and got the 8-ball, and then I forgot that I was going to use it to kill myself. And it took me like all day. I was shooting cocaine back then, intravenous, with a needle. And I got to the end, it was all gone. And then that dread started to come back in around, and I'd remembered that I wanted to kill myself, and I had forgotten to do it with the coke. I didn't have the balls to do it with like a knife or anything, you know, nearly as dramatic. And that was the worst at that point in my life I had ever felt. I literally thought I could die just from feeling that bad. And so when I got Keeping the Moment Alive inscribed on that coin, that was the moment. And so I would literally try and relive that moment emotionally, you know, every time I thought about going back out, or maybe this isn't worth it, or maybe getting sober is too much work, or blah, 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 whatever, because it would remind me how much I didn't ever want to feel like that again. And I do the same shit with hunting. I know the exact moment on the hunt in Wyoming I gave up back in 2017. And I replay that moment over in my head again. Like, even right now, and any other times in my life when I haven't lived up to my potential and I knew it and I was voluntarily choosing to quit for no other reason than I didn't have the discipline to continue pushing forward. And I play those over and over again and I live in it. And it's just like, feel that, suck it up. Like, that's what it's going to feel like if you don't keep going right now. And then when you look at the alternative of keeping going, it's like, listen, compared to feeling like that, not stopping and continuing to go is a joke. Like, this is a no-brainer. How would I do anything else but keep going? So I definitely have some mistakes. There's some other ones that are kicking around, you know, like stupid ones, like bumping animals and like not glassing the right basin and that kind of stuff. Losing my phone on that sheep hunt, for anybody who's watched that hunt film, that one haunts me to this day. The things that haunt me are the things that were my choice. Like sometimes things happen out of your control and you just need to learn to brush those off, because you'll just throw a pity party. And I always say you can never lift yourself up out of the mud with your own boot on your neck. Like you gotta forgive yourself for some shit that's not your fault in the first place. But for those things that when you're objective and you're honest with yourself, that it's like, nope, this one's on me, man. There's no excuse for what just happened. This was just bad decision-making, lack of discipline, lack of foresight, whatever the case may be. Those are the things that tend to play on my mind years after they're gone. Freezer organization hacks. My buddy from up north just sent me pictures of these wire mesh. Mike, if you're listening, thanks, brother. Wire mesh kind of mini totes that he uses from Canadian Tire. And so you pull one of the mini totes out, fill it with all your meat, and then slide it back in. And that way it doesn't slide out of the freezer. Also, this time my butcher just happened to wrap my meat in perfect little rectangles and they stacked up like bricks. So if you can find a butcher willing to do that, that would be another hack. Biggest difference between hunting and success with your New Mexico elk and your BC elk. If I had to narrow it down to one, it would just be the density of elk. Like people don't understand when you draw one of these premium tags, what it's like. Like I was putting eyes on 10 to 15 bulls a day. Like that's the other thing. When you're dealing with like New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, parts of Montana, the southern portion of Idaho, parts of Utah, like you can literally just see animals with your naked eye in a lot of these places. And it's so open and easy to walk around. You can cover 10, 15 miles a day. And then you go to northern BC, somewhere like the Peace, and it's just this aspen-choked hellhole. You know, you can't see anything. The density of elk is way lower than it is down in the States. So your at-bats or your opportunities are just reduced drastically. They were both calling sequences and they were both really, I didn't know much about calling back then, but I was bugling back and forth with this bull. He was held up on the other side of a basin. And then I thought to myself, this is a satellite bull. He doesn't want to come over here and fight. Threw a couple of cow mews back over my shoulder into the opposing basin. And that dude came in on a rope, like sticks popping. He was on his way. So they both came to calls. I shot them both with my bow. One was solo, one was with friends. That would be another one of the major differences. So listen, I don't know if I want to narrow it down to just one, but like the terrain was a major difference. The density of elk was a major difference. Solo versus with buddies was a major difference. There was a lot of differences. But at the end of the day, it's putting an arrow in an elk. So the shit that counts was the same. Best way to boat hunt a river. Run up and float down, run up and down, hike in a game. Yeah, zero experience. I've got run in on a jet boat once, and that was more of like a transportation thing than a hunting thing. A good buddy of mine who I was talking to while on this last hunt said it's very popular for people to run the river and then float down. And they're literally shooting from the boat. They're getting elk when they're out on the river. I think that's very popular. A lot of the terrain at river's edge is really terrible. So I don't think like trying to run in a bunch of different places is super successful. I do think looking for areas with a high concentration of sign, maybe setting a couple cams and then sitting those areas at prime time, like morning and dusk, because here's the deal. In a lot of places, the main rivers are a big walk. So for people who are day hunting, they're not going to be there at sundown because they don't want to do that whole big walk in the dark. And if you can be in a boat and on the other shore and just sitting there until dark, I bet you have a very good chance of catching animals walking out at night. Did the bull put on a show? Yes and no. He was very vocal, but he's obviously a younger bull. 3 years old, maybe, not a giant bull, 5 point. And by the time he was walking in, he came walking in very slowly and deliberately. And didn't make any vocalizations while he was looking at me. I think if I can remember correctly, when he turned around, Ken did get him to bugle or chuckle one more time. But it wasn't like, you know, pissing all over his leg, bugling his face off. It was nothing like that. No. What was the leather moisturizer that you tested and recommended? So that is Obenhaus LP, which stands for leather protectant. It comes in a little black jug. Safety stores will have it, like Ono here in the Lower Mainland has it. And it's a waterproof, waterproofing component as well. I love that stuff. I have not found anything else that I like as much. Some people say the Krispy Kreme is just as good. I don't know. I tried it. I thought it was good, but I still don't think it's as good. Snow Seal's really good. Again, I think it's very good, but I don't think it's as good as the Obenhaus. I think the Obenhaus is the best. Congrats. How did you like the Bino harness? Did you try any of Joel Turner's call methods? I did not. I just don't feel talented enough to do that yet. I still don't even really know exactly what a lost calf sounds like. I almost think it's kind of like wine. I don't know anything about wine. So when people taste wine and say they taste all this shit in there, I believe that they do. I can't taste it because I don't have a developed palate yet. And I know that's true because of the shit that I'm really good at. I can notice nuance that other people who know nothing about that can't notice. So I think you need an ear and a tongue to be able to differentiate elk calls and then make them. And I just don't think mine is developed enough yet. So no, I didn't. And jury's still out on the Bino harness. I'm going to run Catamount on this next one and then I'll start putting my thoughts together. Impact of having the ATV this year versus previous years for this specific style of hunting, invaluable. Despite the setback because of the accident, I don't think I'd have killed. Well, the thing is, we didn't use my elk to kill this bull, but I'm also believe that like all the stuff that happens in a hunt leads up to the success at the end of the hunt. And I would not have been able to hunt the areas that I hunted without it. Not nearly as effectively and not as many of them. It was a necessity, an absolute necessity for me to hunt the way I hunted. Now, if I didn't have it, I would have figured out another way to hunt it. But for how I did hunt it, it was a necessity. And in fact, it was so valuable, I'm dragging the thing all the way to Colorado. Looking at the maps, looking at the ATV trails, talking to locals, I'm going to need an ATV down there to be competitive. And something really nice about Colorado is that most of their ATV trails are for 50-inch wide vehicles or less, which means no side-by-sides. So there's a lot of areas that like the bigger camps with the older dudes who rock up with big travel trailers and a couple side-by-sides are not going to be able to access some of these trails. So yeah, G4 now or the bow rack. What this question is referring to is the fact that Kellen has left the bow rack and he now manages G4, which is another bow shop in Oregon. And the answer is probably G4, to be honest with you. I have not touched my bow. I checked the cam timing on my press once, and I got to give myself a half a twist in the string to get that peep twist out of there. But I have not touched my bow once since Kellen set it up for me, and it shoots laser beams. And so, yes, if I got to drive another 8-9 hours for my next bow to have Kellen set it up for me, done. I trust that guy with my life. What are my plans with the ivories? You know what? I have 3 pairs of ivories now and I don't know. I want to do some kind of jewelry. I don't know if it's like a necklace or maybe I can make some cool earrings for my daughter. Not just have like the whole ivory, but literally carve something out of it. I don't know. A ring, like something. Jewelry is the first thing that springs to mind. If you guys got any cool ideas or pictures for what people do with ivories, let me know. What do you use the red light for while hiking? Is light not light? No, light is not light. And the primary reason you use a red light while hiking is that red light does not disturb your night vision nearly as much as white light. So if you expose yourself to white light, even for up to 5 to 10 seconds, it takes 30 minutes to get 95% of your night vision back. Red light, it's like 1 or 2 minutes. So because rods and cones are saturated by different kinds of lights, I think rods are the stuff that see black and white and cones are what see color. And you hypersaturate your rods with the white light from your headlamp. And when you turn on the red light, it doesn't affect your rods at all. So also, it's supposed to not disturb the animals as much. But even if that's not true, protecting your night vision is the priority. So that's why you use a red light. Have you looked through Zeiss SFLs? If so, thoughts? No, I haven't. But I am contemplating getting a pair. So I'm actually going to be talking to Robbie Denning later this afternoon. Super excited for that podcast. This guy seems like such an absolute stud. Like, after reading his book, I can't wait to talk. This guy's my new idol. Like, I literally, like, all the things that I'm thinking about my own hunting, it's like, how can I be more like Robbie? Like, just such a solid dude, so well respected, so talented, super hardworking. Like, yeah, man, just so excited for this conversation. But he loves smaller binos in your bino harness, so like 8s, and then bigger binos for glassing in your backpack, like 15s. So instead of me carrying just the 12s, because I'm going to be primarily truck hunting, I'm thinking of going back, because I used to do this in Arizona. I would have 10s in my bino harness and I would carry the SLC 15s for glassing. I'm thinking for smaller binos because everybody keeps raving about these SFLs. I might pick up the 8s, and I know Robbie did a bit of a review on them a while ago. So I'm going to ask him, should I get the 8x30s or the 8x40s? So stay tuned. Could have a really cool review coming up on those in the near future. Up next, where would you rank yourself among BC bow hunters? I wouldn't. I'm not. Someday, maybe. I've said this before and I'll say it again. I am not a great hunter. I'm not even a relatively good hunter. I'm an okay hunter. I'm great at being in the mountains. I have 15 years of forestry engineering and tree planting experience. I have no gear like the back of my hand. I can go anywhere on the planet and I would survive no problem. I have a long way to go as a hunter. I think I'm starting to hold my own with my bow. Being able to put down an elk 2 years in a row was a very big deal to me. I value consistency over trophy class as far as my definition of what makes a great hunter. Like, ever since I started hunting, I just want to be that guy that could go out every year and put an animal down. And then once I discovered archery elk hunting, that was the goal. You know, be the guy who could shoot a bull with his bow every year. No matter what, no bullshit, go out there and kill. And so to do it 2 years in a row, I feel like I'm getting that confidence and I'm starting to feel like I'm not that guy yet, but I can become that guy. But as far as where I'd rank myself, I wouldn't. Like, there's guys like Kevin who does the Focus Hunting podcast. That dude is an assassin, man. And he never says shit about it. Like, he's the, like, infuriatingly humble. Like, doesn't even post grip and grins. Like, you don't even know half the shit that guy has killed. It is insane how much shit that guy has killed and the size of what that guy's killed. And he just, it's just not important to him, so he doesn't put it out there. Do you know how many guys there are like that in BC? Like, there are guys who have killed everything in BC and, like, record book this and record book that. They don't enter it in record books. They don't post on Instagram. Like, no, I ain't shit. Listen, I contribute to the hunting community. I'm well spoken and I'm, you know, somewhat entertaining to listen to. And I think I do a good job of trying to help people figure out the best way to go out there and stay out there as long as they can. But yeah, I got a long way to go until I'm a killer's killer. But I'm happy for the process and I will get there. I can assure you of that. What did you learn from this successful hunt compared to last year's hunt? It reinforced the whole, it just takes one. Like, here's the deal. Do you know how many bull elk I saw last year? One. You know how many bull elk I saw this year? One. You know how many elk I killed last year? One. How many elk did I kill this year? One. I saw one and killed one both years. And I think I had this rant in the opportunity sheep film that I just did, that I used to think good hunters were better at creating more opportunities. But then I realized great hunters were great because they only needed one opportunity. And they just didn't make mistakes when they had that one opportunity. And that would be my, I'm very happy with how I conducted myself. You know, with Ken and Nick's help, we were able to find a bull and I held up my side of the bargain. We got a bull in front of me and I put it on the ground. And there's a lot to that in archery hunting. Like there's a lot of shit that happens in those moments. So that really reinforced for me the fact that you just need one. You just need one animal. You just need one bugle. You just need one day. You just need 1 hour. Like it, you can go the whole hunt with nothing happen and you can kill in the last 30 minutes of the last day. So it's like, you just never give up. And that helped me this year because I would get discouraged. And I mean, like, listen, man, last year I spent 20 days elk hunting and it was literally like 2 p.m. on the very last day. Like I had to get home in the truck and drive home that night and I killed. And so I was like, oh, that's what it happened last year. Who knows when it'll happen this year? And so I'm trying to think of what else. I killed that other one silent last year. We called this one. I didn't really leave last year thinking I need to work on my calling much. I left this year thinking I do need to work on my calling. So that was a little bit different. Yeah, those are some of the things for sure that stand out. I'll give it some more thought. What calibers do you hunt? How heavy are your guns? Do you hand load? I have one gun. It is a 300 PRC. It weighs just under 8 pounds scoped. And no, I don't hand load. It's a rabbit hole. I have not gone down. I shoot 212 grain Hornady Precision Hunter ELDX. Are you over-the-counter coos hunting this year? No, I am not. I'm going to New Mexico in January. I drew a archery mule deer tag. Do you find that upper body strength is useful in most hunting situations? To a limited degree. I think you should be in overall good shape, but I don't think you need to be super jacked upstairs. I think you should be able to do, you know, 25 push-ups in a row. You should be able to do 10 pull-ups. You should be able to do like really basic things. I think if you get a little bit stronger and bigger, it's helpful. But I think if you push it too far, there is a point of diminishing returns when you start being just too big. Like I've walked around hunting 270 pounds, you know, juiced out of my mind. And it was the worst experience of my life. My calves would seize up and it was just like, it was terrible. So I do think there is a perfect spot for each individual, but I do think lifting weights is probably a good idea, but I think you can get away with 2 to 3 days a week. Thoughts on the Swaro ATC? Haven't looked through it yet. Have no thoughts. Primitive Outfitters, what are your thoughts? I'm considering a bear hunt. Lander's the best dude in the entire planet, man. Book a hunt. He's the man. And that's it. Well, hot damn. That was a shitload of questions. I hope everybody learned a little something or it was at least, you know, moderately entertained. If you want clarification on any of that stuff, drop me a question either in the comments section or DM on Instagram, mindful_hunter. Again, raffle is live, mindful-reviews.com. Come be a member of the community. We'd love to have you. 275 members as of today. Mind-blowing. Can't believe it. Thank you very much. Headed to Colorado in 21 days, exactly 3 weeks. So super excited for that. Again, I'm going to the Southwest. Still haven't really met any locals. So if you are in the area and you got some, you know, intel, even just logistics and stuff, I would love to have a conversation. Also, I'm trying to think of maybe trying to do some kind of Mindful Hunter or Mindful Reviews meetup, maybe somewhere along the way. So I don't know. If you think something like that would be cool and you want to touch base or try and grab a drink or something, let me know. Yeah. Other than that, I would love some help sharing this content. Like, comment, share, subscribe. Any of that would be greatly appreciated. And as always, until next time, thank you for tuning in.